Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Welcome to the WHU podcast, Leading Corporate Transformation, powered by PwC. My name is Martin Glaum. I'm a professor of international accounting at the WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, and I'm one of the hosts of this podcast series. We're back again. This is the first time we meet in the new year 2022, and we look forward very, very much to new and exciting stories to present to you. With me is Gori von Hirschhausen, partner at PwC, and I hand over to you, Gori.
Thank you, Martin. Hello, everybody. A warm welcome to our listeners also from my end. So I hope some of you already know me, but for those who don't know me, my name is Gori von Hirschhausen. I'm a partner in PwC, leading our management consulting practice. And as a consultant, my job is to support companies on their transformation journey. And this is why my focus for our talk today is to talk about the corporate transformation of Springer and how this translates into the work of the CFO. And this brings me to our guest today. We are very honored and privileged to have Dr. Julian Deutz, the CFO of Springer, with us today. Julian, welcome to our podcast.
Yes, thank you, Gori and Martin. Thanks a lot for having me here, and thanks a lot for coming over to Berlin.
Julian, would you be so kind to introduce yourself and also explain a little bit about Springer to our listeners, who Springer is?
Yeah, I'm Julian Deutz, 53 years old, live in Berlin for the last 20 years with my wife and four children. And I joined Axel Springer in 2004, when actually Axel Springer was more or less a German print publishing house. And by today, and we will talk a lot about that, I guess, we were able to transform really the company into a 80% digital company, international company today. Roughly, Axel Springer, think about it as a $3.5 billion revenue company, highly profitable, 16,000 employees, of which roughly half are working outside of Germany.
So this means, in a nutshell, that Axel Springer is really a prime example for our podcast, which is about transformation. This is really a very exciting transformation story that you look back to. As you mentioned, until the early 2000s, let's say roughly two decades ago, Springer was largely a media and print company, right? With the most well-known newspaper Bild-Zeitung at its core, but also other news papers, regional and national magazines, and a little bit of TV already, I think. But over the last decade, especially very stringently and with lots of concentration, you transformed this company into a digital company, sold a lot of newspaper activities, and as you say, 80% of your revenues today come from digital businesses. What triggered this massive and maybe in some ways unprecedented transformation? Who was behind it? Who drove that?
I think the most important factor is our CEO, who came to office in 2002. He was quite young, and one could argue, did he really have the right background? He was an editor. He was even by education music scientist, he clearly said from day one, and he said that in a company that was doing whatever 99.5% in print, he said our only future is the internet. And if we think back, at least those of us who already had a very active or even professional life at that time, in 2002, the first internet bubble had just burst. People thought, oh, this internet stuff is over. We are over with that, and we are going back to a normal economy. And so there's nothing like this new economy. And he really said, hey, everything we do now will die. We don't know when it will die, but it will die. And unless we really change our business model, we will not survive. And that was a very powerful message, not understood from day one by everybody. But I think this message was a main the main driver for us to go onto this roughly whatever 15 to 20 year journey.
What a story, how daring. Right? So this young guy comes in, he has these ideas in a time when the bubble had just burst, as you point out, right? After the euphoric times of the 1990s, we were back to earth. And he says that, and the company went along with it?
I mean, it took a couple of years till it really took off, to be completely transparent. But he says that from day one. But obviously, there was a lot of resistance because, as in each and every company, those of the managers that were in charge of the most important and most profitable divisions, which was, again, I mean, everything was print, there was regional newspapers and Bild, they didn't really want to hear that, and they probably didn't really understand that. I think things really took off when we did the first larger digital acquisition, which was Idealo. Price Comparisons basically have their offices now in this very building where we are sitting here and doing this podcast. And then we had, for the first time within the management team or the broader like top 100 group, whatever, the jeans and t-shirts guys, and Axel Springer was a super conservative. I mean, 20 years ago, super conservative, founded in Hamburg, you know, blue suits, obviously everybody wearing a tie and so on, quite a little bit political, patriarchal company. And then this culture shift started to evolve, but it took, again, I mean, we haven't done that in 5 years, it took roughly, whatever, 15 to 20 years.
I mean, you mentioned before that it's not just about being a digital publishing, let's say, platform or company. You also said that you are way more international than you have been in the past. The question is, how much does this needs to go along together to become very digital and turn into a more international company? What would you say? How important is this that you go both passes?
Yeah. First of all, when we looked at the kind of DNA of Axel Springer, that is obviously journalism, and we will always do journalism, but journalism in print at some point in time, we don't know when, but it will die finally. And our idea was from day one, journalism will survive, but it will look different in the digital age, and. We also found out over time that the German language is nice and it's spoken by whatever 80 million people in Germany and some in Austria and Switzerland, but this limits you. So with Bild, we were already number one 10 years ago in digital reach in Germany. But to monetize that, we found out that this is simply not enough to turn the whole company around. So we said we have to move into the English language when it comes to journalism, because simply there we can basically address whatever, more than a billion people and not just 80 million. And that's what we did with the first steps to the US in 2014. And now we just did the largest acquisition that this company has ever done with the acquisition of Politico in Washington, D.C.
And looking to the, let's say, digital inspiration, how much came from outside of the German-speaking country? So was it a combination of having more people from the outside bringing also more digital ideas? Have they been further on the road, more maturity in digital questions that you found in other territories?
In general, with every acquisition we did not only gain ideally a good management team and a profitable business model and a value-creating entity, but also we increase, obviously, the overall digital know-how in the company. First, just step by step, and then always it got more powerful. And I think from most acquisitions that we did, if not from all of them, we really benefited also in some other areas because we just got, as you said, Gori, we just got inputs and insights, an even better network, and so on. We also decided, I think it was in 2014, when we did two big steps. We sold our, as you mentioned, Martin, we sold our regional newspapers, which were the very heritage of the company. Hamburger Abendblatt was founded by Axel Springer himself, the first title. So very emotional thing. And we started to send people to Silicon Valley. Because in a management board offsite, we thought Axel Springer, about what he had done in our position now. And we said, yeah, he would have invented the next Facebook. Then we said, okay, we probably won't succeed to do that. But then we said, okay, let's really go where innovation is. And I know now 10 years later, everybody, every business sends people to the Valley. And it's a little bit like a tourism activity. It was different 10 years ago. And we sent even some of our most important people for a couple of months there, so that they also could connect themselves to the ecosystems there, build their networks. And all that, I think, helped bringing digital ideas really into a what was a little bit of an old-fashioned company until the early 2000s. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the first big transaction, Idealo. You mentioned the most recent one, which really, again, changes your structure a little bit with Politico. But you have done a whole string of transactions over the last 15 years or so. My question is, you know, the market for such young and digital companies is not easy. You know, if the companies are already established, if they have a proven business model, they are very highly, extremely highly valued. Right? And if they are young, on the other hand, they are extremely risky. You don't know what, you know, how it will develop. So how do you do that? At which stage do you go in and buy? And then what are your criteria to select businesses that you ultimately invest money in?
First of all, Axel Springer is always was a little bit of a family company or family business. Friede Springer was for a long time until recently a 50% shareholder. Frieda has her office on our floor. We see her. So we never, with any decision, wanted and have not put the company at risk. So we clearly said, hey, whatever we do, even if we are totally convinced today, it can prove wrong in whatever 1, 2, or 3 years out. So that was a kind of a little bit of a portfolio thinking, but was really to limit at least risk. Then when we started to build this digital business or the digital portfolio, prices were obviously more normal than they are currently. Yeah? So we did that, as I said, starting in 2006. So there was definitely an advantage. To repeat the whole story today is more difficult. And I think we took a good mixture of businesses that are just at least have a proof of business, so they have revenues, and we know they would turn into profitability very soon. At the very beginning, we simply said, let's only acquire profitable businesses. After a while, we said, hey, this is not the right approach. But we did it really step by step, and I think we always knew that we don't know everything. Yeah, and so we did it in steps. We never said it's the ultimate goal, whatever, to increase the value of the company by a factor of 10 in 5 years or some crazy stuff. But we always, I think, were very aware of the heritage of Axel Springer, of the role of Axel Springer in the German media landscape, and really took a aggressive, but not too aggressive strategy there, if that makes sense.
Looking at your portfolio, what would you say? What are the most innovative business ideas that you are invested in? What's in your portfolio where you would say this is really something very innovative, looking out into a bright future, not yet there where some of our established businesses, but having a good, let's say, perspective for the future?
Great question. It's interestingly, it's not the most important businesses, probably, because the most important businesses from a financial point of view are the online classifieds businesses, jobs, and real estate. But they are effectively a mix out of, you could say, a classical sales-driven business and a digital platform. But probably the one I would mention or that comes into my mind is Upday, where we are basically aggregating more than 1,000 different journalistic sources and giving a personalized offer to the users. We've spread that out in many, many countries with just small local editorial teams, something we just started totally from scratch. In contrast to the acquisitions that we normally do, this was the first time where we really relied also on our own technical expertise that we can really develop a completely new business model. So that's definitely something we are proud of, I would say.
As you already said, you know, when you do that, these investments are inherently very risky and you don't know what the future will bring. Looking back, can you identify mishaps, really mistakes, and could you draw lessons from them? Is there anything that you say, you know, if you are in such a type of portfolio reshuffle, this is something you should really avoid, or this is something we learned from that?
What we in general found out is that the strong focus that we had from kind of day one, because we always knew in the international perspective with roughly 3 billion revenues, we are not a super big player. We always focused basically on news media and on classifieds. We already, if you would look to strategy charts in 2007 and 2008, you would already find that. And we found out, obviously, the more you've already done in this in a certain area, the less risky additional acquisitions are. So any kind of add-on acquisitions for a kind of buy and build strategy is definitely less risky than to open up something completely new. We also found out that this combination of a completely new business model and a completely new market is super difficult, at least for a company of our size. So we tried either with the same business model, go into new geographies. If you change the business model, stay in a geography that you know well, most likely Germany.
So I don't know whether that makes immediate sense what I'm saying now, but is that because the new business, you know, already builds on what you have operationally and therefore benefits, or is it because you have learned to understand the market and the mechanism?
It's the latter. We have learned to understand the market. We had an interesting experience, one with an acquisition, which was at that time the most expensive acquisition in terms of EBITDA multiples we've ever done. It was in Israel. And the reason why we could acquire that business was really because we went there with all our experts from continental Europe, and during the due diligence process could really find out what were the levers that we really could pull, how could we increase prices, is it really under-monetized. So we bought it for a high multiple, but then tripled EBITDA over the next 3 years. And that's simply a good, probably a good example that know-how is really is super helpful. In general, I would say the fact that we have a lot of continuity on not only on top management level, Matthias Döpfner, our CEO, is still the same CEO than the one I talked about and who was kicking that off in 2002. But for example, also our head of M&A, that's the same person for 15 years. So we've gone through mistakes together. And I think we always sat very openly together and discussed it. Hey, why haven't we found that out earlier? Or what have we got wrong? Was it something wrong in whatever, wrong management team? Or was the acquisition from day one too expensive? And I think this helped us.
A very important question, of course, always is how much do I integrate companies, new business models into the corporate structure of a bigger group? What would you say? How is there a certain logic that you follow, how much you integrate to leave this? Because you also refer to the entrepreneurial spirit that is driving Springer for forever from Axel Springer himself. But how do you keep it in this environment and at the same time, as being the CFO, having a certain level of corporate directive?
Especially in the early days, we had a team with a nice name, Geschäftsführungsbereich Elektronische Medien, sounds in German, I can just tell the English speakers, super, super old-fashioned today, electronic media department. Officially they had the job to develop the portfolio, to find targets and so on. But their real value was they protected the asset from all our nice colleagues in corporate headquarter, from auditors and controllers and the legal people. And we really said at the beginning, the reason for failed acquisitions is often that integration means you basically kill the entrepreneurial spirit. And we always had the idea, I mean, this company that we acquired, Idealo, had at that time 40 or 50 employees, and we had at that time, whatever, 10,000. And we said, if we come with all our power, even if it was super interesting for our people to go there. Everybody wanted to go to Idealo. And we really said, no, you're even not allowed to go there, because if only, whatever, every fifth employee wants to go there once and wants to have a tour through the company and wants to talk to the founders, they won't do anything else for the next 2 years, and then we'll ruin the company. So we really said we only do the absolute minimum of integration that we need. And indeed, as you mentioned, that is finance, because it was always clear we were, for a long time, a listed company. We need it on day three in the new month. We needed final numbers. So they always had to deliver the financial data and also exactly in the timeline and deadline that we gave them. But with everything else, they were very independent, and we always had this idea of this kind of cafeteria principle where you can take whatever you want from the big corporate, but you don't have to take anything. It also had disadvantages, but in hindsight, this is probably one of the big success factors for Axel Springer.
Yeah. So interesting to talk about your portfolio management. I think what we learned is that you started very early with investing in this kind of business models, which are pretty pricey, as Martin was mentioning nowadays. So, and as you said, it's not that easy to repeat this story nowadays. So there we can see again, early movers have a certain advantage in this way of transforming their organization. But maybe changing the topic, coming more maybe to look at your going private, we are very interested, of course, what were the reasons for going private? And then when you went private, you were also being helped by KKR, who is a co-investor in your company. So maybe you can tell us also what's the story behind this and how you work together, how you develop now Springer. So first question, why you went private? And second, how is the work with KKR and how you convinced them to invest into Springer?
So let's maybe try to answer that, or start the answer with a short anecdote. We on the management board were already for quite some time frustrated that the institutional investors on the capital markets did not really value organic investments well enough. We always got nice credit for acquisitions because that was part of our success story. But whenever we came to the market and said, hey, EPS growth, EBITDA growth will be a little bit lower because we take whatever, 20 million and invest in this business, that was seen as difficult and distracting. And analysts said, but I thought, and I've given guidance in this direction. So, and that came to a phase where we basically said, hey, if it would be our own business, so the four of us on the management board, we would probably do things different. And that's frustrating. And now I come to the short anecdote. Matthias Döpfner, our CEO, and I, we were having a capital markets day in London. We were presenting record revenues and record EBITDA. Yeah. And at the end, we were saying, yes, and next year in our real estate classifieds portals, we'll invest probably around 25 million. That's probably not in your plans. And we haven't given guidance on that so far because that's a new development. And this is what we want to do with that. And that will accelerate growth. At the end, we had like 45 minutes Q&A. 30 minutes were on this 25 million investment and with a total negative connotation. Matthias and I were sitting in the car back to the airport for, and it takes in London always a long time, at least in pre-corona times, 90 minutes. And we were both typically frustrating. We said, hey, this does not make any sense. Yeah, either they don't understand it, so the investors or analysts, or we are too stupid to explain, but this is something that doesn't feel good. That was, I guess, on December 8 or 9 in 2018. 1 week later, we kicked off what was called internally Project Heritage and said, okay, we want to see whether we can find an investor. And the task that we set ourselves is that we said, we will draw up a plan in which we believe what we would do if it would be our own business. And then there are only two alternatives. Either we find a private equity investor who buys into that, and then we can take the company private and implement these plans. Or we don't find anybody, and then we have to be honest, then our plans are not good enough, and then we should probably follow the strict rules of the capital market.
But that's very interesting what you are saying, Julian, because there is this very famous quote which comes from Henry Kravis, one of the co-founders of KKR, and he was saying that private equity started holding companies accountable and to make managers start thinking like owners. So my question is, like you are describing it, you were feeling like very entrepreneurial in what you were doing and getting more entrepreneurial power for yourself. Is that one of the reasons why you were able to convince KKR? Because you are already there, what Henry Kravis was saying, PE brings to corporate world?
Yeah, I think there was definitely one factor, probably in addition to obviously our hopefully good track record. And as always in due diligence, you find good surprises. You find some things that look maybe not as good as you thought from the outside. But KKR clearly said, we want to back this management team and these businesses, and we believe in that. And so, here we are.
So how can we envisage that today? You know, private equity, traditionally at least, is their approach is to take companies over completely and to do that in order to subsequently change things and change them in a fundamental way, structurally, and also in the operations. And, you know, especially in the first years or so, they have bi-weekly reporting and very, very drilling down in all. Do they do that? Do they watch you so completely? And do they, you know, talk to you about all sorts of KPIs every day?
Yeah, KKR has done now a couple of minority investments in Germany. I think they have, experience that this also can be a very value-creating and attractive approach for them. When you compare Axel Springer with other targets, at least of the European activities of KKR, we are a relatively large company. We were, by the way, at that time, the largest tech private Germany had ever seen. And obviously, with this size of Axel Springer, there goes a certain professionalism. So the feedback that we got after 1 year was, hey, in average, the companies we invest in are significantly less professional than you are. And this is why many things that we normally do, we didn't need to do here. Yeah. But what we have and what is contributing to the value of Axel Springer is a very constructive and in times very intense dialogue, super open, yeah, very to the point. It's still polite, but we really clearly say and get feedback what we believe is right and what we believe is wrong. So we are all in a way united or aligned as owners, so the top 100 people are in a way feeling and are incentivized like owners. That helps. And I would say the most fundamental change was that the management board plus the like top 100 executive do not look so much on quarterly and annual results. Quarterly results don't play a role at all any longer. And with everything that we do, and that's something that in theory sounds easy, but that was not in our DNA before KKR joined us. We really now think whatever we do, is this increasing value over a 5-year horizon? And now out of this roughly 5 years, 2 years are already over. So we look at always roughly 2025, whether that at the end is 26 or 27, doesn't matter. But that, this view in terms of value creation and not in terms of what is my EBITDA guidance and what is EPS and what is the tax ratio, but really look, this investment, if I invest in Build Life, so the television activities of Build, will that over 5 years create value? And if so, let's do it. We are so much faster than we were at the capital markets because we always had this fear. We always want to avoid, as every CFO and every management team, a profit warning. So that means if somebody comes in May and says, hey, Julian, I have a great idea, but I need whatever, 50 million. We would have said, hey, that's whatever, 8% of our profits. We cannot give it to you in terms of OPEX to diminish EBITDA. If we have that today, we say, hey, if it's a great idea, present it to us. If we on the management board believe it's the right idea, we give it to our shareholders. And the whole thing is a process of 4 to 6 weeks. And then we can do things. And that's also totally not only motivating for us, but also super motivating for our teams.
Absolutely. I do fully believe that this is very inspiring. But coming back to your CFO role, and I'm pretty sure that you still have direct interaction with KKR and they are asking, of course, also at short notice, certain information they want to get. So just give us a little kind of an impression. How do you work with KKR on this? How much questions do they have? What kind of questions you might sometimes also say, this is something I don't answer because we look at this long term. So maybe you have some results where you can show a case that you also kind of educated your investors.
Yeah. I mean, overall, the role of the CFO when in terms of communications to shareholders changes drastically between a public and a private company. And I experienced that. So in a public setting, basically, there's one CFO talking to whatever, 100 or 200 institutional investors in a rather shallow way because the typical investors meeting is 45 minutes. So given our relatively broad portfolio, in 45 minutes, you never get super deep. Here it's totally different. You have basically one shareholder, actually with CPPIB, that's a Canadian pension fund. We have a second one that is combined with KKR and Axel Springer. But basically you have one or two investors talking to the CFO very intensely with obviously more time, but also talking to the heads of our most important operations. So there are simply more people now doing investor communication, if you will, than before. But I have obviously probably the single most intense contact with KKR, which is simply part of the role. So I'm talking to my shareholders not each and every day, but definitely each and every week, and probably exchanging emails, not all the time, but very often. I believe what PE is doing, and that's totally fair, they put your organization, especially the finance organization at the beginning, in a little bit of a test mode. They want to find out, what can this organization deliver? How professional are they? How fast are they with any data that we need? How accurate is that data? And from all what we heard, and we cannot obviously not praise ourselves here, that was very satisfactory for our shareholders. So you see that some things are easing after a certain time. And I guess I would follow the same approach if I were in their shoes.
Mm. Yeah, it makes sense. Let's for just a quick moment come back to the digital transformation with all these acquisitions you've done over the last 10, 15 years. What is your role as a CFO there? I mean, naturally, you will be involved in the financial aspects, divestments, acquisitions, the money, you know, needs to come from somewhere and so on. But to which degree are you also involved in the strategy that is behind that? And in the selection of the companies and the criteria you use for that?
Yeah. I'm very much involved in that. And I'm working there with our CEO and my board colleagues very intensely, because effectively, when we were listed, I was the one who was, in a way, transmitting and communicating this strategy to our shareholders. I was doing whatever, 90% of our investors meeting without the CEO. And obviously, the most important ones, the CEO did together with me. And while, as we just discussed, communication mode has changed a bit, this has not changed. That's a CFO, and I believe that's a prerequisite for a successful CFO, is at the table when we discuss the strategy, when we believe what is the right target for our job platforms or for our news media business. And is not only delivering flawless execution, that's a, in a way, what you always have to do, but is an important and integral part of the strategy discussion.
You were saying you are, of course, in this role asking for information, you are asking for numbers. The same is true for KKR, asking you for numbers and all other owners. So my question is, how much is it just a push of a button? How much do you invest into digitization of your back office processes and your finance processes to provide these numbers and to have your finance people focusing more on insights than on transactions?
Yeah, the idea that we have, and this goes together with the approach that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that we said we need like financial data in the way we require them, but we don't want to interfere much into the business of our digital units. And this is why we said, hey, this is the financial data that we need. If you do that with SAP in your unit, or whether you do it with whatever Workday or some other tools, honestly, we don't care, as long as this data is there on whatever this date at this time in this format. Then on like in the holding or in headquarters, we invested a lot in super integrated systems. We invested a lot in a fast close procedure. So we know now, whatever on January 5, what is the result of the old year across now, whatever, more than 200 companies that we fully consolidate. So that is a super professional, fully integrated system. There's only one truth, and the truth is with headquarter controlling, period. Yeah. So if somebody asks what's the growth rate of StepStone, this is the one source that we need. And that is determining all the external, or also internal, in a way, communication and analysis. And there's not the thing like, oh, yeah, they look at this EBITDA, but we look at this and we don't know what's right. There we are kind of strict. But how the units organize that. That's up to them. Obviously, if we see that it's super inefficient, then we push them to do it in a better way. But we have invested in digitization and in fully integrated processes quite a bit over the last decade, I would say.
So your activities are very diverse. You still have the traditional, print media, Bild Zeitung, of course, and the Welt. You have internet media like Politico. You have advertising platforms, but you also have financial portal. It's a whole range of things. How do you manage and how do you control and how do you steer such a conglomerate? Are there uniform reporting requirements for all of the businesses? Do you have uniform KPIs that apply to all of them, or is it diverse by business?
We have unified financial reporting requirements. We don't have unified KPIs because, as you say, whatever for a Bild Zeitung, at least for the print part, you need different KPIs than for a purely digital classifieds business, for example. This looks from the outside a little bit more complicated than from the inside, I guess, because what we do, obviously, we have different segments. Then within the segments, you have a kind of substructure. So it is not that difficult to get on whatever within, if you see the monthly report, to get a very good view over the first 2 minutes, whether this was a good month and where are the problems. There we have super professional controlling colleagues and controlling mechanisms and really find out extremely fast where there could be problems. And in the past, obviously, we did wrong management decisions as everybody else, I guess. But what we never had is over the last 15 years, wrong or materially wrong financial information, so that whatever people thought until July or August, this business is on a good way, and then something happens, they had to correct numbers. This is simply not happening. Therefore, we are luckily so much too professional.
So that sounds very promising. I think we could talk for hours on all these topics. And of course, I can tell you a lot of CFOs would be very interesting to learn how you ensure this good and strict way of reporting and having digitization being applied in the finance process. But looking at the time, let's come to our final, let's say, questions we have. So you are one of the first WHU alumni that come from Otto Beisheim School, right? So let us know, at that time, what made you take the decision to go to this, at that time, pretty small university? And what would you say? What was it that you learned there that maybe is still very present in your daily life of today?
Yeah, I always wanted to do something with business or economics. My parents were both medical doctors, and I knew already at the age, I think, of 10 or 12 that I never wanted to do that. I was simply not interested. And at that time, public universities were super crowded because it was basically this baby boomer generation. I'm born in 68, and there were all these stories from you don't even see your professor, and if you don't get into this class, you have to wait a year longer to get into that. So in the even obviously very good public university systems, it was simply overcrowded. This was not super attractive. It was a very national model at that time. And then the first private business schools really evolved with a promise of small groups, direct contact to the professor, and an international exchange, which is normal now, but which was not at that time. And that was something that a couple of schools could offer. And actually, I took some time and really went from whatever, St. Gallen to Reutling to WHU in Koblenz and looked at them. And then I applied only at WHU, Martin, I have to say. And I was accepted and very happy to be so. And I've never regretted that for a single second.
A good decision,
yeah.
We would say. Last question, Martin.
Yep. Well, maybe last. But one, I would like to add one more question concerning the career, because I think that's very interesting. You, after a brief stint in consultancy, you joined Steilmann, a textile group, and you assumed at a very young age, very quickly, positions of some significance. You joined them as head of finance, basically, and later on as the CFO. At that time, they were already in financial difficulties. I think that's fair to say. So how did this come about, this relatively early, position of importance, and what are things that you have taken from this?
My first project manager in consulting, he was a crazy guy, and he was leaving Zen Consultancy to become managing director of Stahlmann. And he basically gave me a call a couple of weeks later and said, hey, this is a crazy company here. Nobody knows even how many subsidiaries they have. They don't know what, they didn't have a consolidated balance sheet. The banks are making it difficult because they want to have real data and they don't get it, and business is going down.
Interesting.
I need your help. And then I met with him a couple of times, and I always, when I knew that I didn't want to do anything with medical stuff, I wanted to understand how really a business functions. And honestly, I mean, I loved consultancy, but in a consultancy, I wouldn't say that you really learn that too much. So I wanted to go in a real business, and that's what it was. And I was there like in two different stages, like roughly 6 years altogether. And there's so many things that I've now in a kind of executive position that I know, like whatever, one or two levels below me, people are dealing with. I was dealing during that time myself. And that is super valuable because, honestly, in a good mid-sized company, German Mittelstand, you really learn things from scratch, and it's not super fancy. And the businesses where the headquarter was basically on a big parking lot in Wattenscheid West at the A40, which is the most crowded highway Germany has to offer. But you really learn things from scratch, and you're so close to what really drives a business and how a finance function works or doesn't work. So in hindsight, that were not the easiest, probably the most difficult, but the most, in a way, exciting years of my professional career, I would say.
It sounds like it. So we have a tradition to close this podcast with one question that we ask all
very
the
important question,
a very important question, and that is whether you have a book recommendation to our listeners. I learned, have to say, I may add that you are have quite a reputation as a man of the books, and that you can that people listen to your recommendations. Do you have a good recommendation for our listeners?
I hope I have a good recommendation. It's a book that I read shortly after Christmas. It's called Berlin 1936, Berlin 1936, and describes Berlin over the 16 days of the Olympic Summer Games in 1936. Oh, okay. And it's not a real documentary. It's different stories that go into each other. If anybody has read Florian Illy's 1913, which is more popular, at least in Germany, it's a little bit that style, and you get a really cohesive and super interesting picture of how Berlin during these 16 days has looked and how the atmosphere was. And it was obviously the Nazis already quite strong. People knew about concentration camps already existing, whatever, just 40 or 50 kilometers out of the city. On the other hand, everybody trying to make Berlin look as a very cosmopolitan, very open city, because that obviously what the Hitler government wanted to create this impression. And during that, they tell stories of individuals who have whatever, be it a cafe or a bar at Kurfürstendamm or in this area. And this in total is really a very dense, in a way, atmosphere. You really, if you read that, you really feel you've been there.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, Oliver Hilmes is the author.
And being there is, I think, the perfect phrase for today. We have been with you with the Springer story, with your portfolio, with your daily job as a CFO. It was really, as I said in the beginning, it was an honor. It was a privilege to meet you, Julian, and to have this talk. I do believe we might want to make it a chance to talk to you again one day and make another podcast. So we hope that you take this invite again, and thank you so much for today and your input and your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Invite already accepted, and it was a pleasure. Thanks, Gori.
Perfect.
And Martin.
Wonderful. This was probably the longest, or is probably the longest podcast we've done so far. I can say that, but I think it's completely justified with the super interesting story we had. My thanks also, you know, a super interesting partner to talk to with Julian, many thanks. And thanks to you, listeners, for listening in. And we hope to meet with you again very, very soon.
Looking forward.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks, everybody.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.